Jeb hits the web, Tim has plenty to say about Iowa, and the Kits hits the fan in Oregon. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington, and this is The Political Junkie.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 63 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Jeb Bush fulfilled a pledge this week by releasing almost 300,000 emails from his 8 years as governor of Florida. It was part of his promise to be open and transparent. But apparently in those emails are addresses and social security numbers of Florida residents, and now he's being accused of violating their privacy. While Team Jeb tries to fix the problem, there appears to be some tension at Team Hillary. David Brock, the former right-wing hitman turned left-wing hitman and a Hillary Clinton supporter, quit her super PAC, accusing officials of preparing an attack on his own pro-Clinton groups. A day later, Brock reconsidered his charge and was said to be rejoining the campaign. Perhaps much ado about nothing, but it was a rare case of airing dirty laundry in the likely Democratic candidate's budding campaign. Meanwhile, as both Bush and Clinton try to inoculate themselves from troublesome headlines, Rand Paul and Chris Christie continue to get battered from their earlier comments about whether vaccinating children for the measles virus should be voluntary. So far, such comments haven't spread to other potential presidential candidates. And the governor of Oregon, John Kitzhaber, is under fire over allegations made against his fiancée. She's accused of using her position as the governor's unpaid advisor to help her consulting firm and line her pockets with more than $100,000. The state's largest newspaper is calling for his resignation, and the attorney general is investigating. Kitzhaber, the longest-serving governor in Oregon's history, has insisted he won't step down, but the state capitol is awash in rumor. It's a fast-moving story. Things aren't going so well for Benjamin Netanyahu either. The Israeli prime minister is scheduled to address a joint session of Congress on March 3rd. But more and more Democrats, the latest being Vice President Joe Biden, plan to skip the speech. I'm still not convinced that the speech will happen, but he keeps saying he'll be there. And a member of Congress has died. Alan Nunnally, a well-liked, strong social and fiscal conservative from Mississippi's 1st Congressional District, succumbed to complications of a stroke and brain cancer. He was 56 years old. Nunnally was first elected in the Tea Party wave of 2010, ousting Democratic incumbent Travis Childers. Before that, he spent more than 15 years in the Mississippi legislature, rising to chair the Appropriations Committee. Governor Phil Bryant has to call for a special election within 60 days, and that election must be held within 60 days after that. And we still don't know what to make of the Brian Williams saga at NBC. He stepped down as anchor of the nightly news as the controversy over his past statements about Iraq and Katrina are under review and has now been suspended without pay for 6 months. The pounding he's taken on social media is enormous. I wonder how anyone can recover from it. Somehow, I'm reminded of the opening words Williams had for a presidential candidate in the 2007 Democratic debate.
Words have in the past gotten you in trouble.
And here's another wrinkle. Every time there's a mention of him misremembering what really happened, we're reminded of the story of Hillary Clinton and her saying, incorrectly, that she came under sniper fire when she landed in Bosnia in 1996. She can't possibly be enjoying the Williams story. And whoa, Jon Stewart is leaving The Daily Show. Okay, I'm flattered by all the emails and notes suggesting I take over that job. Thank you for that. I really appreciate it. But I'm making a Sherman-esque statement right here and right now. Mr. Peabody is the smartest dog in the world.
Well, now that you're here, we may as well get to know each other. My name is Peabody. I suppose you know yours. I guess you're wondering about this contraption. It belongs to Sherman. He's my boy. Here, Sherman. Here, boy. Shake hands. Say hello.
Hello.
Smart as a whip, isn't he?
Okay, well, lots more to talk about. But first, the trivia question. As many of you should know, this weekend is Valentine's Day. who was the last serious candidate to run for the House, the Senate, and the presidency, who was born on Valentine's Day, February 14th. Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner, as always, will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. And if you want a sneak peek and a head start on each week's trivia question, plus daily updates on the latest news we're following, head over to our Facebook page. We post the question there a day early. We'll give you the answer to last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned. This week, Jeb Bush did what he said he would do, releasing some 250,000 emails from his 8 years as governor of Florida. It's part of his promise to show openness and transparency. Unfortunately for him, there have been other stories about him in the past month that may be too open for his liking. The Boston Globe published a high school tell-all of Bush's younger years as a pot smoker and a bully. And not long after he hired Hipster.com's founder to be his chief technology officer, his digital guru, the guy's name is Ethan Zahor, it was learned that Zahor years ago posted over-the-top social media posts about gay men at his gym and sluts. He quickly deleted most of those posts, but not quickly enough. The damage was done, and within a few hours of the revelations, he was gone. Even the release of Bush's emails didn't go over smoothly. Many of them included personal information, such as email addresses and social security numbers, and you thought only Brian Williams was having a bad day. Anyway, Adam Smith is the political editor of the Tampa Bay Times and has long been on the Jeb beat. Welcome back to the Political Junkie, Adam.
Good to talk to you, Ken.
Well, what do you make of this? A rough couple of days for the Bush campaign? Much ado about nothing? Something in between? What?
I think it was probably rougher for the Brian Williams folks. But, you know, Florida, something that people have to realize outside of Florida is we have long had a tradition of very liberal open records laws. And the Sunshine State applies to our access to government as well. And so Jeb really, I think he wanted to make a big statement that he was Mr. Transparent, but really he wasn't doing anything that people didn't have access to already. So it was more of a symbolic thing, and he got some headlines across the country as a guy willing to release all this information that, you know, a Chris Christie's not able to boast about. But this is all information that a lot of us were going to get, and many of us had already gotten through public records requests.
So there were 250,000 emails. You've read every one, correct?
I have read every one, yes.
Tell me, is there anything, I mean, of what you've seen, is there anything you learned, anything we need to know? Any headlines?
I have not read every one. PolitiFact will correct me if I say I've read every one.
No, I was smiling when you said that.
Yeah, but, you know, I think probably the main takeaway from this, I mean, barring something that we haven't noticed that's really startling here, and mind you, these are not his private emails, his political emails, where we don't have access and probably have some more juicy stuff in them than these do. But the main takeaway is he is and was a very hands-on chief executive. I mean, the guy really was spending hours and hours a week responding to the most banal constituent emails. And a lot of people would get these emails from Jeb, and they would assume it's some low-level underling responding to some minor complaint about government bureaucracy. And it really was Jeb. He was reading this stuff.
Do you see anything in the release of the emails, and this is one of the criticisms of Jeb Bush, or at least one of the conversations about Jeb Bush, but anything there that will either hurt or bolster his credentials as a conservative?
No. I know we had reviewed some of the Terry Schiavo ones early on. We'd sort of focused on that. It was one of the stories we did. So in terms of a social conservative, I think there'd probably be some of the folks that are looking for a social conservative might find reason to cheer that he was certainly willing to take risks, willing to spend some political capital in the name of life, or at least intervening in this family matter to keep this brain-damaged woman alive.
Well, the reason I asked that question, I mean, I think you know the reason I asked this question a few weeks ago when Jeb Bush's name was mentioned at the Iowa Freedom Summit in Des Moines. He was greeted by a bunch of boos, the Tea Party folks just really don't trust his conservative bona fides. But you wrote back in December, you wrote something that I thought was a very convincing rebuttal, that he was a very conservative governor with very conservative policies and hardly a moderate squish, as you say.
Well, it is something that's a little baffling, and it probably says as much about how far to the right the Republican Party's moved. But it's quite baffling for some of us that were here in Florida, where Jeb Bush was sort of exhausting. I mean, he was a very activist, viewed as a very activist, very conservative governor. And he was privatizing everything. He was bashing and attacking the teacher union before it was cool to bash and attack the teacher union. He was immigration just wasn't really a hot button issue at that point. So, yes, and you know, school accountability and testing, you know, Common Core did not exist, and it wasn't a bad word. That was a conservative position he took back then, and now it maybe. It happens to be also he shares some of the same educational policies as Obama, or maybe because he shares some of those policies, it's toxic to a lot of Republicans, the Common Core.
Another Florida Republican, Senator Marco Rubio, seems to be heading in the direction of a presidential candidacy. There was once some thought that he wouldn't run if Jeb were running. Can Rubio get traction in Florida, get good fundraising going with Bush also in the race?
I think Florida is going to be very hard for him. I think Jeb Bush just really does have a giant shadow all over most the vast majority of the money people in Florida. But, you know, who knows? I think Jeb is still he may be the ostensible front runner. He may raise a lot of money and the establishment guy, but he's not a very good speaker. And once you start getting on the stump, Marco Rubio is a great speaker. I think a case could be made that Marco has a shot. He's not going to be able to compete much for money in Florida, but maybe he can be the sort of young, energetic alternative to Jeb Bush.
Do you expect him to give up his Senate reelection to run for the presidency, or is the filing deadline in 2016 late enough that he could make a bid for president early and then fall back to the Senate if his bid doesn't go anywhere?
It is definitely late enough that he could fall back to the Senate, but he has said repeatedly that he will not do that. And as you know, politicians never go back on their word.
Absolutely, right.
But I do sort of take him at face value that, you know, he's taken some veiled shots at Rand Paul, saying he is not somebody, Marco, who would run for both Senate and president at the same time. So I do sort of take him at his word that he probably wouldn't keep that as a fallback, his Senate seat. And I should add, there's a very widespread belief among the sort of lobbyist core in Tallahassee that Marco Rubio really, he's going to run for president, and then, assuming that doesn't quite work out, he's going to run for governor after Rick Scott, and he'll run for governor in 2018.
Adam Smith is the political editor for the Tampa Bay Times, and you can follow him on Twitter at Adam Smith Times. Adam, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Ken.
Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker is leading the GOP pack in Iowa, according to a recent poll from the Des Moines Register. 16% of Hawkeye State Republicans say he's their choice for president in 2016. Walker's tough battle for re-election last year kept him close to home. But with his election behind him, he's been spending a lot of time in Iowa. And he got high marks for a speech he gave a few weeks ago at the Iowa Freedom Summit. More than a few pundits, some who should know better, have actually called him the front runner. Finishing second in the poll with 15% is Rand Paul. Paul didn't make it to the Freedom Summit last month, but he's been to Iowa a bunch of times last year and was there just last week. It's always good to get early, favorable reviews in Iowa, but what does it mean and how lasting is it? Tim Pawlenty got those Iowa favorable reviews in 2011. A former two-term governor of Minnesota, he was heralded as a Republican who could win in a blue state. He would unite the business and social conservative wings of the party. He campaigned in Iowa with an impressive organization and sharp TV commercials. But he finished a disappointing third in the Iowa straw poll that summer, and that was the end of his campaign. He announced his withdrawal on ABC's This Week.
We needed to get some lift to continue on and to have a pathway forward. That didn't happen, so I'm announcing this morning on your show that I'm going to be ending my campaign for president. But I'm very, very grateful for the people of Iowa, the people of this country who I had a chance to make my case to, and for my supporters and staff and friends who've been so loyal and helpful. I really appreciate all of them. I wish it would have been different, but obviously the pathway forward for me doesn't really exist, and so we're going to end the campaign.
What did he learn? What was, what is, the real meaning and importance of Iowa? Tim Pawlenty is here to answer those questions. He's the president and CEO of Financial Services Roundtable in Washington. Governor Pawlenty, welcome to The Political Junkie.
I'm glad to be on The Political Junkie, Ken. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, I've been reading all these reports out of Iowa, who's up, who's down, the endorsements, the staffing, the money raised, all of that. Even the polls, although it's still a full year before the caucuses. I guess my initial question is, how closely should I, and the political community in general, how closely should we be following all this stuff? How meaningful is it at this point?
Well, at this point, I would say it's not very meaningful, but certainly when you get on the doorstep of the Iowa caucuses themselves, Ken, it becomes much more meaningful. So you asked about lessons learned or mistakes during my campaign. One mistake or lesson learned was we overweighted the importance of the Ames straw poll, not to be confused with the Iowa caucuses, which happened in February. The Ames straw poll happens in the preceding August. And frankly, you know, straw polls have become a dime a dozen. They come and go, and a week after they happen, nobody really cares. And the Ames straw poll used to have more, you know, I think, panache than it does now. It's still an interesting event. It's still a fun event. It's still one that I think should occur. But I think everybody should just chill out as to its meaning. It doesn't really mean anything. It's never really successfully predicted the outcome of the Iowa caucuses, much less the nomination. And, you know, one of the lessons we learned is we, you know, overemphasized the importance of the Iowa straw poll and really overemphasized it when we realized that Michelle Bachmann was going to get in the race. And frankly, she was the type of candidate who could do well in that kind of narrow-casted contest. So, you know, we would have done things differently in hindsight, but as they say, that's 2020.
Well, you mentioned Michelle Bachmann, and that's fascinating to mention because, you know, she won the straw poll in August 2011. At the time, the Washington Post said her win is, quote, likely to provide her with considerable momentum as the 2012 race ramps up. And then she finished last in the caucuses the following winter. So I guess my question is the straw poll overrated? And in looking back in your hindsight, could you have survived a third-place finish in the straw poll and kept going?
Yeah, if we had the money, and that leads into a discussion about a candidate like Scott Walker. But yeah, you know, if we had to do over again, once Michelle got in the race, I think we would have probably, you know, pulled out of or de-emphasized the straw poll in terms of our resource allocation because it was clear, you know, she was going to be appealing for that type of event, but perhaps not in the longer haul or the longer poll. And then, you know, Ron Paul was in the mix at the straw poll. So we would have done that. But then if you're going to stick around and persist, which is an important part of this process, you've got to have substantial funding. And as being from a small state and not having been through a recall effort, you know, I did not have that network of established national donors and did not have a super PAC. And Scott Walker, amongst others, is going to have, you know, a significant national fundraising capacity. He's going to have a super PAC, and that alone is going to distinguish his ability to persist and increase his probability of success.
I asked you about the importance and the value of the Iowa straw poll. What about the Iowa caucuses themselves? I guess the reason I asked that is Mike Huckabee won them in 2008, Rick Santorum won them in 2012, and neither went on to win the nomination.
Yeah, it's not a dispositive of who's going to win the nomination or even ultimately who's going to win the next few states, but it's certainly a piece to the puzzle, an important piece to the puzzle. Better to win it than not win it. And Mitt Romney won it, you know, for a while last time, and then in a recount, Rick Santorum won. But it's still meaningful. It's not, again, it's not the only thing, but it is one thing. But if you look at the four pillars of what it takes to have a successful campaign, you know, they are, first of all, you got to be qualified to be president of the United States based on some past experience. Two is you've got to have the requisite philosophy to get through kind of the gatekeeping scrutiny that comes from your party, so you can become the party's nominee, so you can then have a chance to win the general election. Three is you've got to have the right amount of money to be credible and be able to persist as a candidate, because there's going to be some ups and downs, and there's going to be some good weeks and some bad weeks, and to be successful, you got to be able to persist through that, you know, including having the resources to do it. And then four, in the modern era where politics and news and entertainment are blending together, you have to cross a threshold of being able to inspire and entertain. And that's part of it, sadly or not, but that is certainly part of it too. So those are the four things you look at, and you can apply that to the candidates in the field and reach your own conclusions about how they might do. But clearly, Scott Walker and others, you know, can check those boxes.
Well, the thing that many people said about your candidacy 4 years ago was its potential of uniting the business and Tea Party wings of the GOP. Is it feasible for somebody to do that today?
Yeah, I think so. You know, you look at successful candidates and you think of the Republican Party, it's really a coalition. So it's the component parts include, you know, social conservatives, economic conservatives, libertarians, Tea Party types, national security hawks, establishment types, Chamber of Commerce types, and more. And so you've got to be able, you don't have to be able to win every one of those subgroups, but you've got to be able to win a couple of them substantially. And then you got to be able to at least get some support from the others, or at least not freak them out. So, you know, you could be a fire-breathing a conservative activist, and that could get you the attraction of the grassroots. But if you, you know, scare the donor community, you know, they're not going to support you, and that's going to have implications for your campaign and your ultimate ability to be successful.
Well, when I read the newspaper clippings, when I talk to journalists, everybody says, well, the establishment choice is Jeb Bush. But there are clearly those on the right who detest him. When his name was mentioned at the Iowa Freedom Summit by Donald Trump, of all people, it was met by widespread boos. So,
yeah, there's a gap, can you, between, you know, Jeb's got clear early support in the amongst the donors, but you know, you also have to get support on the ground from the activists. And so he's got some work to do in that regard. Others have support from the activist community, but don't have support in the donor community. And you've got to be able to ultimately do both. So he's got some work to do on one side of the ledger. Some other candidates have got some work to do on the other side of the ledger.
Is anyone impressing you, especially at this early stage, doing the right things on the road to the nomination?
Well, this is a different field than last time. You know, if you think about it, as Mitt Romney, who had, you know, resources and a super PAC and had run before and, you know, clearly kind of was the front runner early on and ultimately went on to win the nomination. But it was sort of Mitt versus the also-rans. I mean, if you looked critically at the rest of the field, you know, most people would conclude that the rest of that field wasn't going to be president of the United States because of either some personal or political baggage, or because they didn't have the resources or the, you know, the national platform or structure to do that. This time you've got, you know, a financial front runner in the form of Jeb Bush, but the rest of the field, many of them are also going to have money, and they're also more credible in the sense that they're governors, they've got successful careers. And so I think it isn't going to be Mitt versus some also-rans who are going to implode. It's going to be a Mitt-like figure in the sense that you got a front runner with resources and then a bunch of other candidates who are going to be credible and be able to hang around the race with money and be much more competitive, I think, than the field last time.
You were on the very short list for vice president in both 2008 when McCain picked Sarah Palin and in 2012 when Romney chose Paul Ryan. I actually thought it was going to be you in 2008. I had lost a bet. But do you think about that much?
No, I don't. You know, that moment kind of came and went. And, you know, I think John McCain in 2008, you know, selected Sarah Palin for a whole variety of reasons that didn't work out well for him or for the campaign in the sense that they didn't win. But, you know, life goes on, the years go by, and you move on to the next thing, which is what I've done. But I don't think about that much, no. And, you know, I think he was, you know, counseled that he needed to kind of shake it up and do something different. Otherwise, he was going to lose the race. And so he took an element of risk or some more risk than in that pick than I think others were comfortable with.
What's your lasting memory of Iowa and 2011?
Well, you know, my campaign was so brief. I didn't think I had a lasting experience. But you know, look, Iowa, it was a lot like Minnesota in the sense that, you know, the people and the geography and the culture and the history, there's some commonality there. So it was comfortable to me. to campaign there. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, if you, like I said earlier, once Michelle Bachmann got involved in the Iowa straw poll, you know, that's something that, you know, was a very material development that we didn't adjust for. And we should have, you know, kept our modest resources closer for so we could have a longer trial and a longer hearing. But we thought Mitt was going to pull away from the field and leave everybody in their dust if we didn't, you know, make an early statement and have some early success. And it turned out to be, you know, the race unfolded very differently. The race went on for many months afterwards.
If candidates or prospective candidates for 2016 came to you for advice, what would you tell them?
Well, I would say, hey, look, don't do what we did, which is put all your chips down too early on the sense that this thing's going to move away from you. You need to be able to persist, and so meter out your resources accordingly. And, you know, in today's world, you got to have a super PAC, and so, you know, you got to have some friends who are able to do that appropriately and legally and ethically and all of that. And then enjoy it. I mean, it's a privilege of a lifetime to be able to cast a vision for where America should head and why your leadership can positively impact and affect that. The people and the process are terrific, and it's a wonderful honor to do it. And so smile, enjoy it. And it's something that most people never get to do, and it's a great honor to do it. So treat it with the joy and the respect it deserves.
Tim Pawlenty is a former two-term governor of Minnesota who was, briefly, a candidate for the 2012 Republican presidential nomination. He's currently the president and CEO of Financial Services Roundtable. You can also follow him on Twitter at Tim Pawlenty. Governor, thanks so much for being on the show.
My pleasure, Ken.
We all know the expression, keep Portland weird. Oregon's largest city is known for, shall we say, its eccentricities. In a quick visit to the city last September, I think I saw more tattoos, more strangely dyed hair, and more half-dressed people per square mile than I've ever seen anywhere else. In fairness, I did like the voodoo donut shop. But Portland and the state in general is hardly ever known for weird politics. Yes, they've had the sad cases of Senator Bob Packwood and Congressman David Wu, but maybe we can blame Capitol Hill for those two. The latest weirdness is closer to home, and the situation is quite fluid. John Kitzhaber, a Democrat elected to a record fourth term as governor last year, is under fire. As we record this week's show, he's still governor, but rumors are flying that he may not be for long. The controversy is about Sylvia Hayes, his fiancée, who serves as an unpaid advisor. But in that capacity, she has allegedly cashed in, using her contacts to get about $180,000 on contracts that have to do with her work associated with Kitzhaber and his administration. While working as the governor's advisor on environmental policy, for example, she made $118,000 from the Clean Economy Development Center. One newspaper reported that she received an additional $85,000 in other consulting contracts related to her duties as advisor to the governor. She's also accused of not reporting this money on her IRS tax filings. And there's more, and it's rapidly changing. And that's where Chris Layman comes in. He's the Salem correspondent for Public Radio's Northwest News Network. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ken.
Chris, and thank you for bailing us out. I mean, things are happening so fast. I know things are in flux. What's the latest you know?
Well, the latest is, of course, the most important thing is that John Kitzhaber remains the governor of Oregon. And at this point, despite all of the rumors, there's no specific indication that he's planning to step down. The Oregon Attorney General recently opened a criminal investigation into the governor and the first lady. But of course, the governor is the one who stands to lose the most out of this. It's not clear what specifically the Attorney General is investigating. She just said she's going to look at some of the allegations that have come to light recently. But that, of course, has got to make everybody stand up and pay attention because, you know, criminal charges would be a serious thing.
And what exactly is she being accused of?
basically, she's being accused of selling her influence with the governor. She has long been working in the field of green energy, so that's nothing new. But since she is so close to the governor, she has been accused of basically accepting money, contracts to lobby for things, relating to green energy. And reading between the lines, it's that she's using her influence with the governor to try to shape public policy while getting money on the side from companies that may stand to benefit.
Is it worth mentioning that Kitzhaber initially appointed Rosenblum to her job, or is that become an issue at all, or is she seen as truly independent?
I think there are a lot of people in Oregon who question whether she can, in fact, conduct an independent investigation. They're calling for an outside special prosecutor to be appointed. It is true that the governor did appoint Ellen Rosenblum to the attorney general's office a number of years ago when the previous attorney general resigned midterm. However, Rosenblum did win election to a full term on her own accord, and so it doesn't specifically owe the governor for her current position.
What are the requirements to get a recall petition on the ballot?
It's very difficult to get a recall petition for a governor on the Oregon ballot. You have to get about 15% of the registered voters to sign a petition, and that's lots and lots of people, of course, and you have 90 days from the point at which you file your recall petitions to gather those 220,000 signatures. And of course, some of them will be invalid, so you really have to gather a lot more. And that takes a lot of money to get people on the street to gather those signatures. The additional wrinkle is that you have to wait until the office holder has been in office for at least 6 months from the start of his or her current term, which in John Kitzhaber's case, he took the oath of office just last month. So we're really talking about mid-July when they could start circulating these petitions. So they'd have 90 days. And then that, of course, only gets it on the ballot. It'd have to go on the ballot, and you'd have to convince more than 50% of voters to kick the guy out of office. So it seems like getting recalled is probably not his chief concern at the moment.
Let's go back to Sylvia Hayes for 1 second, the fiancée/first lady. She became an issue during last year's campaign. There were two major controversies. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's very interesting that last fall we were talking about the First Lady's fake green card marriage. She admitted to marrying a young immigrant a number of years ago, I believe about 15 years ago, if I recall correctly, and marrying him for money. She received money, and they got married. He got a green card and still lives in the country as of last accounts. And, you know, she quietly divorced him a number of years later and apparently told no one, including her current fiancé, the governor of Oregon. Well, that was an embarrassment for her. She had a tearful press conference during which she apologized, but people kind of understood that it wasn't John Kitzhaber's fault. He didn't know anything about it, as far as anybody knew. The other embarrassing revelation around that time is that she was in a relationship, again, more than a decade ago with somebody, and it was kind of unclear, but they sort of got some land in upstate Washington to start a marijuana grow operation, which at the time was illegal. Obviously, Washington has different marijuana laws now, but it certainly, again, was an embarrassment, both of which, you know, the fake green card marriage and the pot farm might have been criminal actions at the time, but nobody was talking about prosecuting her. But it certainly became a distraction in the last month before the governor's race. But it should be noted that already at that time, there were initial press reports of some possible ethical lapses by the First Lady and the governor when it came to her consulting contracts. So, you know, those things were already on some level known prior to the election, an election which John Kitzhaber won handily. I mean, it really wasn't that close. He beat his Republican opponent, Dennis Richardson, you know, very easily, at least on paper, and appeared to be settling in for a fourth term.
How are the state's Democrats and Republicans responding? Are they responding according to party lines?
It's interesting because, well, first of all, the legislative leaders clearly on all parties, but especially the Democrats, are finding this to be a distraction. They just started a legislative session a couple of weeks ago. They have a very ambitious agenda, and most of the reporters here, including myself, are not reporting on much of it at all, except in drips and drabs as we can. So they're annoyed. They have not called for the governor to step down. They're offering sort of the tepid support of, well, he's going through a rough time and let's see how this all plays out. Republicans, surprisingly, at least among legislative leaders, have not called for the governor to resign either. It's possible that they think a weakened governor of the opposite party might actually benefit them. They may also wish to keep the current governor, who, from a policy standpoint, does have his moderate tones, and the Secretary of State who would replace him should he resign, Kate Brown, is known for being more liberal and having a very cozy relationship with public employee unions. So Republicans may actually prefer John Kitzhaber stay in office. They certainly have figured out that they don't actually need to do anything for him to be weakened at the moment.
I know there's no way of answering this question with any assurance. How long do you think this investigation could go on for?
Yeah, I don't know how long the criminal investigation will last. I think you'd really have to say months. I mean, if the attorney general came out next week and said, oops, well, we didn't find anything, nobody would really believe that. You know, then again, will people even care when summer rolls around in Oregon and we have the coast and the mountains beckoning us? I'm not sure. But it could be a very interesting year for Oregon politics for those who do keep paying attention.
And you have that voodoo donut shop as well, right?
Exactly, yes.
Chris Lehman is a Salem correspondent for Public Radio's Northwest News Network. You can find him on Twitter at Capital, with an O-L, Capital Currents. Chris, thanks a lot for helping us out today.
You're quite welcome.
It's time for This Week in Political History. It was a big announcement from Evan Bayh, the Democratic senator from Indiana. For his supporters, however, it was not the announcement they were hoping for.
After all of these years, my passion for service to our fellow citizens is undiminished, but my desire to do so by serving in Congress has waned. For some time, I've had a growing conviction that Congress is not operating as it should. There is much too much partisanship and not enough progress. Too much narrow ideology and not enough practical problem solving. Even at a time of enormous national challenge, the people's business is not getting done. I will not, therefore, be a candidate for re-election to the United States Senate this November.
5 years ago this week, Evan Bayh cut his political career short. He spent nearly a quarter century in elective office, 2 years as Indiana Secretary of State, 2 terms as governor, 2 terms as senator. Several times he was thought to be on the Democratic shortlist for vice president. At least once he seriously considered running for president himself, but he never did. And where is Evan Bayh today? Why, he's our guest on The Political Junkie. Senator Bayh, thanks for being on the program.
Ken, it's great being with you, and thanks for the walk down memory lane.
When you announced you would not seek re-election to the Senate, you talked about the lack of bipartisanship that existed in Congress, that things were not getting done. Now, we're only talking about 5 years ago, but has it gotten worse?
I think it has gotten worse, Ken. I don't think it will always be worse. I'm still an optimist about America's future, but when I observe the institution from outside and when I talk to my former colleagues who are still there, unfortunately, I think the political polarization is at least as bad, and yes, probably somewhat worse.
Do you think both parties are guilty of that? And I think the reason I ask is I saw that when you announced you were retiring, I remember there were a lot of good riddance messages, not from Republicans, but from your fellow Democrats.
Well, the major motivating forces in politics today, the most passionate people, the ones who tend to give the most money in campaigns and volunteer the most and respond to announcements like mine the most, tend to be on the extreme. So on the Republican side, it tends to be the Tea Party element. And on the Democratic Party side, it tends to be the most liberal element. And if you look at my record, first as governor and then in the Senate, I tried to be a pragmatist. I tried to reconcile differences. I tried to find principled compromises. And regrettably, on both sides, including some on my own, there are people who, if you're not with them 100% of the time, view you as a traitor of some kind. So that's one of the forces that is leading to the polarization. And to answer your question directly, yes, that exists in both parties.
I remember when you announced your retirement, you threw out a big thank you to Dick Lugar and how closely you worked together. Are Democrats and Republicans allowed to work together? And the reason I asked that question, probably a little a question in quotes, but when Democrats and Republicans work together, they are seen as sellouts by the extremes of both parties.
Well, it has changed since my father's time, and my father is viewed as being, you know, fairly liberal, and proudly so. And he would work with people like Dick Lugar. He'd work with Republicans to try and find common ground. And that was considered to be an act of statesmanship in those days. As I said, today, trying to work with the other side, trying to find a sensible compromise, is viewed not as an act of statesmanship, but instead as an act of betrayal. And so we do get this phenomena, as I mentioned to you before, that members of the Senate who vote with their own party, let's say 90% of the time, which, you know, where my kids are in school, 90% gets you an A, but people obsess on the other 10%. And what they end up with then, not in very blue states or very red states, but in states that can go back either way, what they end up with then is, rather than someone who votes with them 90% of the time, very often they end up with a senator who votes with them 0% of the time.
In your retirement announcement, you said you were an executive at heart. How would you compare being governor to being in the Senate? And how seriously did you consider running for president?
Yes, being an executive clearly influenced my thinking, and I think it's a great background to have because you have to make things happen, not just talk about making things happen. Now, with regard to the presidency, I did get off my medication there for a period of time and thought about running for the presidency. It's a tremendous honor to have participated in at least exploring that possibility. I went to Iowa, I went to New Hampshire, I went elsewhere. And to be quite frank, Ken, with you and your listeners, in a field that included now President Obama, Secretary Clinton, who may very well be the next president, and back at that time, John Edwards, who was a significant candidate. He ended up having some real difficulties, but at that point, he had not experienced them yet. In that field, I concluded that I just really did not have a realistic chance of winning. And that being the case, thought that if I did go ahead and run, it would be mostly about my ego and that sort of thing. And I didn't think that was an appropriate basis on which to run. There are occasionally people in public life you see who just can't go to their graves contented unless they've thrown their hat in the ring for president. And I didn't want to be one of those people. It, for me, it needed to have at least a, you know, some 10%, 15% chance, something, some material chance of actually being in a position to do good things for the country. And the politics just wasn't aligned at that moment for me.
I used to see your dad on the metro every now and then, and he was always completely approachable. How's he doing? I can't believe he is 87 years old. I just can't believe that.
I know. It's my father was always the youngest this or that, and he is now 87. But if there is such a thing, he's a fairly youthful 87. He you know, reads, he writes. Until recently, he taught a class at Washington College over near Easton, Maryland. And he still gets out and walks around a track near his house, you know, 3-4 times a week. And thankfully, Ken is mentally very sharp. And so he's doing great and just very proud of him. And one of my sons, my wife and I have twin boys. And I guess the biggest honor I could pay my father is that one of my sons is named for him.
And actually, your first name is Birch, isn't it? Aren't you Birch Evans by the third or something like that?
Yes, we're not very inventive in our family. my father was named for his father. I'm named for my father, and one of my boys is named for all three of us. So I hope we can keep it a good name.
Well, I remember when he ran for president in 1976, the button said "I'm bipartisan." That was pretty inventive.
Yes, there were some mischievous takeoffs on that. We're a little bit different connotation, but you know, it's an unusual name. It fits well on a bumper sticker. And, you know, we had bipartisan, we had bi-American, we had, you know, good things like that that the marketing folks in the campaign loved.
And in 72, when he was thinking about running, there was Goodbye Nixon. I remember that one as well. When you think of your 20-plus years in public service, what memory do you cherish the most? And where do you think you made the greatest difference?
Oh, I think I made the greatest difference as governor of my state. And, you know, you asked me before about some things. Appointing the first woman and the first African-American to our Supreme Court in the entire history of the state of Indiana. Neither had ever served on our state's highest court. Advocating for and signing into law a law called the 21st Century Scholars that gives every child in the state of Indiana whose family qualifies for a free or reduced lunch program, the less economically fortunate, a free college scholarship to a public university of their choice if they sign a written pledge in seventh grade to stay away from drugs and to graduate from high school. Tens of thousands of young people in our state can't have gotten a college education because of that. That's a wonderful thing. In the Senate, I tried to be a force for sensible leadership, both following 9/11 and in our response to the greatest financial crisis since the 1930s. But more than anything else, you know, I'm very proud of the Democratic friends I have. I'm proud of the Republican friends I have. And I tried to always be a voice for reconciliation and reminding everybody that we may be from different political parties, but we're Americans first. And so I hope that's a small part of the legacy that that I left there.
You're only 59 years old, and there are always whispers that one day you'll return to Indiana and run for governor again. Is there any possibility of becoming a candidate one day in the future?
Oh, I don't think you, you know, close any doors in life permanently. And I do miss public service. I enjoy the opportunity of getting up in the morning and thinking about how to make the world a better place and help people improve their own lives. Thankfully, Ken, there are a lot of paths to take that you can achieve that without running for public office. That's what I'd tell my two sons. I'd say, I hope you devote a big chunk of your life to trying to help other people. But you can do that through teaching. You can do that through philanthropy. You can do that through appointed positions. You can do that through the military, just a whole host of ways. So that chapter in my life may be behind me, but as you said, like, I think 59 is not ancient. So you just never know. But some kind of public service, absolutely. Running for office, probably not, but you never know. By the way, to our progressive friends, you know, I would only note that, let me just look at my state legislature. And one of the reasons I decided not to run for governor this time, our state House of Representatives, Ken, is 71-29 Republican, and our state Senate is 40-10 Republican, and 7 out of 9 congressional seats are Republican. Of course, we have Joe Donnelly. That's a little more complicated situation. But my point simply is, you look at my – I used to always be somewhat amused, some of my colleagues in the Senate and some of the different advocates that you referred to. It's easy for them to say things when they come from New York or California or Massachusetts or for some very liberal, some Democratic place. Try come and be a Democrat in a really conservative Republican place. You know, that's a little bit harder. And I often wish some of them had had that experience. Perhaps they'd be a little more understanding.
Senator Barr, that was wonderful. Thank you so much.
Oh, Ken, I really enjoyed it. And thanks for asking about my dad. Yeah, his birthday was just 2.5 weeks ago, and we spoke, and he's doing great, and a man I admire. And who knows, maybe one of my sons will go into the family business too.
Evan Bayh is the former Democratic governor and two-term senator from Indiana. He's a partner with the McGuire Woods Law Firm in Washington. Senator, thanks so much.
Ken, my pleasure. Again, thanks for the memories.
It was 5 years ago this week that Evan Bayh announced his retirement from the Senate, ending his long and undefeated career in Indiana politics. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin.
Oh, the moon was shining bright along the wall there.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of our latest trivia question, which was... We know that Russell Wilson is the first African-American quarterback to win and lose in back-to-back Super Bowls, but who was the first African-American politician to win and lose in back-to-back Senate races? The answer? Carol Moseley Braun. a Democrat and the first and only black woman ever elected to the Senate. She won her seat in 1992 and lost it in her bid for a second term in 1998. And the winner is Jessie Walker of Huntington, West Virginia. What does Jesse want, as we used to say? Well, he gets the coveted political junkie button. And how about last week's scuttlebutton puzzle? Only two buttons there. The first was for Dwight Gooden of the New York Mets, and the second was for former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty, who ran for president in 2012. You add Gooden to Pawlenty, you get...
Love a good and plenty, and a vote for good and plenty is a vote for me. Good and plenty, good and plenty.
And the winner is Kimberly Culbertson of Hillsboro, Oregon. As always, check out our website for the latest campaign updates, scuttlebutton puzzles, political columns, trivia questions, and more. It's at krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Charlie says, really rings the bell. Charlie says, love my gun and plenty. Don't know any other penny that I love so well.
With Valentine's Day coming up, it made us think about love and relationships and the difficulties of making marriage work. We know about how money and children and in-laws can cause complications. How about politics? Now, we know lots of couples whose politics are vastly different. Think Mary Madeline and James Carville. But what about when husband and wife run against each other for public office? That brings us to Waterville, Maine. It's a mostly Democratic town of about 16,000 people, including Jennifer and Dave Johnson. A few years ago, Jennifer, a Democrat, and Dave, a Republican, decided to run against each other for Waterville's Ward 1 warden position. We know how negative campaigns can get, but what happens when the two candidates are married? We thought we'd check in with Jennifer and Dave on this Valentine's week and see if the scars from their vicious attacks on each other have healed. I'm kidding, of course. Jennifer and Dave Johnson, thanks for joining us and welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thank you very much. This is an exciting thing to happen.
Dave, you're there?
I am.
Okay, I just want to make sure you're there, too. I noticed the two of you are not together. Is it because you haven't reconciled since that ugly and brutally vicious campaign you had? No.
No. It's more of a physical distance. He's on his way home from work.
Okay, I was trying to make a good story here. Okay.
Yeah.
So the fact that you're still together makes me think it was not an especially ugly campaign.
It was not an ugly campaign at all. It was... I ended up running for a position because there was nobody running for it, and I don't like to see empty spots on the ballot. That's just depressing to me that no one even cares enough to try to do something. And so when I told Dave that I had signed up and as a candidate for that position, he said, "Well, I'm going to run against you." And it was just a funny thing that we thought we would be the only ones that knew about, and people might see that the names were the same on the ballot and wonder if it was, you know, any relation. But it was really just kind of a joke for us.
Dave, how old were your kids? How old were your kids at the time?
At the time, they're 9, 7, and 6 right now. And this was the fall of 2013, right?
Yeah, 2013.
Yep.
So did they enjoy this? Did they have fun with it?
Oh, they thought it was wonderful. They are very enthusiastic cheers and said they were hoping that mommy won, and I trained them well.
I was going to say, do you have any idea who they would have voted for? So they all would have voted for mom?
Well, yeah, but they're mama's kids. That's how kids at a young age are. They're all about mom until they're teenagers.
Well, Dave, who'd you vote for?
I voted for Jennifer. And I took a picture of it.
He did. He sent it to me. He sent it to me and said, "Look, there you go. I voted for you."
And Jennifer, how about you? Who'd you vote for?
Oh, I voted for myself.
How did the two of you meet? Did you guys talk about politics at the time?
You know, we really didn't. We actually met online back in 2002. Yep. And when we finally met up in person, we clicked. We had both just moved to Anchorage, Alaska, and didn't know anybody. And that's how we ended up meeting.
And you didn't talk much about, did you talk much about politics or, I mean, what got you to Maine actually? What got you to Maine? Cause Alaska's looking at a map, it looks pretty far away.
I'm from Maine. And when we had our first kid, we really wanted to be closer to family, and all of my family's in Maine. So Jennifer's family's kind of spread out, so we decided to come to Maine.
I see that the position that you ran against each other for was Ward 1 Warden. What in the world does that mean? What does a warden do?
Well, you get to do really awesome things, like you can hand out I voted stickers, or you can replace pens in the polling booths when people walk off with them, or you can say this is how you insert your ballot into the machine. But it really, it's an elected volunteer position. It's the folks that are helping out on election day, whether it's handing out the appropriate ballot for folks' districts or directing foot traffic to line up nicely and wait their turns. But it's just helping out on election day. And so 2 days a year, you know, the warden has a job, and that's in the primaries and in the general election.
I think you work more hours than some members of Congress.
It's possible.
What was election day like? It sounds like it was a lot of fun. I mean, was it nerve-wracking? Did you campaign together?
No, we didn't campaign. The only reason that people knew we were running against each other was our local reporter that covers politics figured out that we were husband and wife and wrote a story on it, and it just captured people's attention, and that really was the only way that folks knew. But it is a primarily Democrat town, and the expectation was that I was going to win. But even if I hadn't, we both said we're more than happy to help out on election day, and we didn't realize there was, you know, a great need. There's not as many people volunteering at the polls as there have been in the past. And the folks that generally do it are retired persons, and they're slowly trickling away. And so it was a needed thing to do. And it's not something that I think someone should have to be elected to do.
Dave, when they counted the votes, did you cry fraud? I mean, there's a lot of fraudulent elections going on in this country. Was this one of them?
You know, if it would have been closer, I probably would have asked for a recount, but it wasn't very close.
It's again, you know, this is a few years later, and it sounds like the two of you had such great fun with it. Do you have any advice for people who can't seem to be able to talk to someone from the opposite party?
I think that you just need to listen respectfully to what they have to say. And when you speak back to them, that you need to be respectful of them as well, because if you're listening to someone and realizing that they are believing what they're believing for the same reasons that you are, which is we all want things to run smoothly. We all want everyone to have enough to be happy and fulfilled and follow their pursuit of happiness. We all have the same end goal. And just because we disagree on the right way to get there doesn't make us each other's enemies.
Dave, agree?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, if you really peel back the layers, most people agree on most things. But like Jennifer said, it's the method in how we reach those goals. So,
Jennifer, have you thought about running for higher office? I mean, we haven't had a President Johnson in a long time.
No, I really don't have a desire to do that. It's not something that I am thick-skinned enough to do.
But the thought of President Johnson, I mean, doesn't ring in your ears saying you don't go to sleep at night and say, wow, America needs a third President Johnson after how great Andrew and Lyndon did?
I'll let another Johnson step up to that one.
Dave and Jennifer Johnson are the political powerhouse couple in Waterville, Maine. You can find Jennifer, that's Warden Jennifer to you, on Twitter at Jen with two N's, Jen AK77. Dave and Jennifer, thanks so much for being on the show. And happy Valentine's Day to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I guess all those things we've always find for GI love.
That's it for this week's show. Political Junkie is made possible with support from WAMU here in Washington, and is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. For political columns, trivia questions, scuttlebutt puzzles, and bad jokes, check out our website at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You could also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or shoot us a message on Facebook. Our producer and editor is A.D. Quigg, Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer, and Alex Drewinskis is our engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.